You're listening to Magic From Wherever I'm At with your host, the magician, time traveler, and charmer, D'Artagnan.
And that is what I'm afraid is going to disappear. It's not about money. It's not about fame. It's about learning a skill, which, if applied correctly, can ascend to the school that you're talking about, having meaning, having real meaning. And I have had students, I'll shut up in a second. I've had students that have come back to me, I don't know how many years later, but many years later, and they've said, you know, Ben, it wasn't just that you taught me how to do a trick or a sleight of hand. It's that what you did made people look at me differently. And I can never repay you for that. I'm glad it worked out for you. But isn't that what you're talking about? Is that taking it to a level beyond entertainment?
Yeah, well, I'm not even so sure it's beyond entertainment, because that's something I sort of broached in my book, was like, what is entertainment? Because we have this association with entertainment. And if you look at like the dictionary definition, it has to do with distraction is one of the, stock sort of definitions. But that's not really what you're going for. They may be distracted from their life to some degree, but you're really looking for more engagement, if anything. You're looking for engaging on a different level. And so I think the thing that gets lost is the meaning part. And that was a part of entertainment from the get-go. But somewhere along the way, people forgot that, or they rebelled against that because they thought that was, and in some cases it can be. I mean, when you do it badly, when I tried to, I can never find a good way to shoehorn it into like the literal presentation. It does, and you see movies do that nowadays a lot. It's preachy and it's all kinds of suck.
Yeah.
You know, because it's just like so blatant. It's like, you're just, this is what this is. We shouldn't be doing this. It's like, you're just telling people it. What it should be is you're demonstrating it.
And yeah.
And then they are intuiting through the demonstration what you mean. And so you have to have this, you have to give them the, it's funny you referenced earlier 2+2, because you have to give them the 2+2, but then they have to arrive at the 4.
Okay.
And that was a very popular thing in movies too, throughout their inception, was like, I've been studying a lot recently. Like I referenced Walter Murch earlier. I've been studying a lot about cutting, about how editing and cutting.
Sure.
And they talked a lot about that. The earlier Russian filmmakers like Eisenstein and Kuleshov and people like this, talking about how the juxtaposition of the images gives the meaning, and how, you know, individually those things don't mean anything really. There's just a guy with a blank stare on his face, but you cut it together with what he's looking at, or you know, it just become the sort of film language, with the next shot being the what he's looking at. Now a meaning is arrived at, is inferred. And so there is something to the, we've lost this idea that entertainment has a message to it that should be baked into it, that is not blatant and preachy. It's not the telling, it's the demonstration of it. I mean, that's really what a story is. It's like you're demonstrating through this fantastical tale, you know, that really, I mean, I've never been a shepherd. I've never been approached by a wolf, you know. To me, that's just as foreign as, you know, orcs and wizards or whatever. But there is a morality underneath that of how you should conduct yourself. And that's the part that seems to be lost. And that seems to be across the board in music, you know, all kinds of art.
I agree. I'm going to go out. We're going to go on 4 hours and 10 minutes. So I'm going
to... Yeah, we have to unplug
it. I'm going to call it then. I'm going to give you 11 minutes more. Call it an even 4 hours. But I hope you get some material.
Oh, yeah, we will.
Card index thing out.
You'll save me months of work. Down stuff.
Hilarious. here's my thing. You are saying that entertainment had meaning, it disappeared, we want it back. Now, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. Two examples that feed that you can see online. I'll send you a link if you don't see it. But 7 years ago now, I was in Monte Carlo at the circus festival. I was covering it for Vanish Magazine. Very exciting to watch 4 days of circus in a row. Pretty much the same acts. They were sort of competing World Series of Circus. The concluding act is called Sokolov, S-O-K-O-L-O-V, Sokolov. They are the world absolute none better masters of acrobatic flying. And, you know, some guy runs up, jumps on the teeter-totter, and launches the other guy off the other end of the teeter-totter, 50 feet in the air, doing 8 somersaults, and lands in a chair. This is extremely dangerous stuff.
I bet.
And they stick it every time, except once. He's tethered when he's flying, but when this guy hit the chair and bounced out and went and is coming down, you know, in 0.2 seconds to land on somebody in the audience, that could be game over for the festival.
Right.
So this is serious, serious stuff. But they did their show, which you can see online. Just look under Sokolov and then Monte Carlo Circus Festival 2014 on YouTube. You will see that it's not just an acrobatic act, but what they did was they fashioned this entire thing as the court of Louis XVI.
Mm-hmm.
These are courtiers doing a dance. These are men chasing women. These are women being silly. These are kings saying, okay, you can. They tell a story with acrobatics.
Gotcha.
It is not to be believed because they're wearing powdered wigs. They're doing crazy stuff in the air. They're doing stuff in the air. You won't even, you'll look at it, you'll go, what just happened here?
Right.
It's a little beyond. And it's not an acrobatic act and it's not a pantomime. It's
right.
So it became something else. That's number one. Number two, there's a movie out there, real indie. I'm going to tell you now, folks, put your money on the movie Sound of Metal to win Best Actor. It's all they're nominated for, which is a crime, but it's called Sound of Metal. And okay. The actor's name is Riz Ahmed.
Oh, I know who that is, yeah.
Okay, he was in a Bourne movie. We love that.
He was in a Star Wars movie, too.
Yes, he was. Riz Ahmed is killing it, people. Here's the story of this movie. I'm not an idiot, but I just play one on TV.
Sure.
Here's what I did. The movie comes up. We're watching up. SAG member voting on this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Streaming, you know. Mr. Robinson, are you going to be in your seat at 8 o'clock? We want your vote. Yes, sir. I'll be there. The movie comes up. The subtitles are on. I turn to my wife, Ann. The subtitles are. Will you turn the subtitles up? I can hear the movie. I don't need the subtitles. She starts screwing around the keyboard. She can't turn the subtitles up. I go, what the hell is this? He's playing the drums and it says drumming. I'm like, I don't need to be told this right now, except the movie is about the drummer going deaf. The filmmaker literally takes you into the world of being deaf. Or hearing impaired, I'll be politically correct. But right. the thing is, I have never seen a movie in my life that gives me the experience of being a deaf person.
Right.
Holy guacamole, Batman. My point is, this movie isn't just about deaf people, made by some people who are hearing impaired. Paul Ritchie is, he's in the movie. But it actually penetrates you sitting there on your bed watching this on your laptop of, oh my God, this is what it's like to be deaf. I should pay more attention to that. It's a movie. I don't think they spent more than $1 million making it. I think it was made in 2018. It's just being seen now because of the difficulty getting an indie film seen. But it's fought its way to the SAG nomination. I hope they do very well. But I voted for films that have meaning and, you know, broke the form or did something new. And I'm a cineast too. And another phone call, we'll just talk about film all day. But the thing is, I don't know that the species really has got the appetite to groove on this stuff and make the intellectual jump that, oh, what I just saw at the magic show or in the trippy movie or in the sculpture or gee, honey, you think we should take a walk to the library today to just look at what books are there? I think that is on its way out. I think they want it, but I don't think it's on the rise because it's too much work. I think people, especially in the pandemic, are worried about, do I have enough money? Do I have enough food? Do I have enough shelter? Sure. Do I have enough fuel for my car? Do we have Band-Aids? Do we have hydrogen peroxide? And by the way, why is that guy coughing outside my door? I think we're in approximate caveman land. And that is my sadness because, I'll get to my book plug to close out. But mm-hmm. when the pandemic started, I was at work in my trippy little weird world on several different events. Like there's this knife thrower in Pennsylvania named Eugene, and he's really amazing. And I wanted to come up with a stunt that Eugene would do that no one had done before that would be beautifully filmed. And that scene in the film, The Outlaw Hero, which is out now, and you can see it on Vimeo or go to my website, illusiongenius.com. Go to the writer page, go to the home page, just look for Outlaw Hero, you'll get it. Anyway, the thing is, the movie is about freedom now. We say that right at the top of the show. We say it during the show, but we didn't really plan that. If you've ever made a movie, you shoot it, then you put it together. Then you find out what your story is because of what footage you have to work with. Well, gee, we can't show Rick being upset if we don't have a shot of Rick being upset. We forgot that. We didn't have the light. He didn't show up. He was drunk. Oh, fuck. We got to go get a guy being upset. So you do with what you have. And the thing is, at the beginning of the pandemic, I wasn't willing to let all my projects go. Sure, I'm not going to Lucca, Italy to do the party. I'm not going to New Orleans to do the reading. I'm not going to San Francisco to do the close-up gig. So what are you going to do? And my publisher and I decided I would, one, write a book, and then I would, two, make a film about the content of the book. The book is called The Outlaw Hero. We are going to be on Amazon. For some reason, there's some shakeup. We haven't been there for 3 months, but we will be there, I'm told. Anyway, it's on lulu.com. You can buy it from the publisher or the printer. But the thing is, it's my autobiography. And who is the Outlaw Hero? Well, let's go into literature. Robin Hood, Zorro, the Lone Ranger, Batman. These are all characters that have an oath. And what's Batman's oath? He's incorruptible. He's not going to use a gun. He's going to kick your ass through cleverness and all his little ninja stuffy roonies. He's Batman. He's not going to lose. But he's not going to pick up a gun and shoot you in the head.
Right.
Because he's Batman, and Batman doesn't do that. See, it's very simple. Right. The Lone Ranger, too. Now, the Lone Ranger carries a gun, but he doesn't really use it. He may fire it in the air, but he's going to beat you with cleverness and his fists and politics and the rest of it. Robin Hood, rob for the rich, do for the poor. All of a sudden, he's not going to become the slave owner of the poor. He's a good guy. And Zorro, too. It's very similar to the Batman story. He's a millionaire who hides as a outlaw hero. He's helping the poor downtrodden at night wearing a mask.
Right.
So why is this my autobiography? It's because that's what gave me meaning as a magician, that I can go anywhere and do anything, not break any laws. I want to be very clear about something. To be an outlaw hero, you don't have to break the law. You just have to skirt the law.
Right.
There's a difference. You can go do a show where you don't have your so-called license. Do a show, make money, you didn't hurt anybody, and you leave. You may have even brought patronage to the area that you're in. But it's still outlaw because the guy down at the city hall, he's a real pain in the ass. He never gets his license. So, okay, fine. The city hall didn't get their lousy $15.
Right.
But the point is, you weren't doing anything wrong.
Right.
You weren't hurting anyone. And so I'm using the metaphor of the outlaw hero to say, okay, guys, here's how I did it. I was 15 years old. I said I wanted to be a magician. What do you know? It's 45 years later. I'm 60 years old. Here's all the stuff I just did. Right. And by the way, here's my friend Eugene. Watch him throw knives. It's killer. So the end of the movie, just so everybody can fall in love. So I'm on Instagram, right? And I have this friend, he's a knife thrower named Adam Chelladay. He's world's greatest super Muhammad Ali knife thrower. Just famous, you know? And so Adam rings me up and he goes, dude, you should check out the greatest hits knife thing I just put up on Instagram or wherever. I go, okay, fine, I'll look at it. Well, it's all about this woman named La Loba, the wolf.
Yeah.
And so he goes, dude, I am introducing the wolf to the world. You will not believe what this woman can do. Well, this woman goes airborne on a snowboard and she's throwing knives into trees. She's airborne. The knives are airborne. It's insanity. And she's doing backflips and she's throwing. She is. So I immediately call her up, right? I go, hi, I want you to be in my movie. I want you to do your insane stuff in my movie. So what does she do? She gets on a slack wire. You know what a slack wire is? It's like a loose tightrope. She's walking on the slack wire, very pretty, wearing a dress. She takes a soda can in her left hand. She throws it at a target. The can is airborne. And while the can is airborne, while she's standing on the slack wire, she takes a knife and no spin, meaning there's no rotation. She no spin throws it directly over and pins the can to the target. In slow motion, for everybody can see. Then she continues walking on the slack wire to the target, pulls the can out of the target on the knife, walks to the camera, takes her hat off, and puts it over the camera. It's the end of my movie. Now, my point is, that's outlaw, right? You shouldn't be able to do that. But look what she did! And so my point is, going off on the whole meaning thing, is I'm trying to give people hope. I want the people who can't pay their electric bill, can't pay their car insurance, are looking in their refrigerator going, wow, pasta again tonight? Yeah, I guess it's pasta again tonight because I'm not going outside.
Right.
It's screwed up. There's a garage. There are people without masks. That guy's dead in the ditch, I think. I don't know. You know, it's really wiggy. Those people are the mental health crisis that we're dealing with. And this is not like it's, oh, gee, New York City or gee, Nashville. This is global. The species, our inhabiting species, is being tested. It is being challenged. It is being eradicated, certainly. And we are going to have to deal with this and the best we can. So my way out of it, I'm speaking purely for myself, was to say, okay, you artists in Virginia that I'm dealing with who are creating a totem to my pigeon friend Clyde.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I need that for my movie. Now, you, Broadway drummer who's tearing all over the place at $100 gigs per. Yeah, I need 3 hours of your time. Now, you, knife thrower. I got all these people together. We had 9 cameras shooting on 3 working sets. It was complete guerrilla making insanity. I'll give you my baseball card statistics. We carried over 2,000 pounds of wood through 6 states with 12 people in 6 days and shot something like 40 hours of film to get 12 minutes out of. But we hope it's going to be a commercial for my book, The Outlaw Hero. We hope people buy it. The New York Times has been really generous with, you know, certain comments I've made and links spread around. And that's been groovy as hell because they're trying to help me. Well, it's no skin off their nose to say, look, this guy broke his ass. You might want to take a look. And there's some killer shit and it's completely for free. Wait till you see my tightrope lady. She'll knock you out.
Right.
So that's where I am, but I don't know where to move on to. And I don't think we're going to know until things change. Yeah, what's your thinking on that?
If you're looking for just the right flooring, you need choices. And at Marshall Carpet One, you'll find thousands of choices, including carpet, hardwood, rugs, and luxury vinyl. So make the right choice and visit Marshall Carpet One and Rug Gallery. And we promise, with more than 50 years as a family-owned business, we've got you covered!
Yeah, that's probably true. Until it takes another twist, I don't know if we'll know exactly what form things will take because right now it's definitely got a where you're not allowed to congregate, then live shows are kind of, I mean, you do see it slowly coming back though. Like, I would say that there's a lot of comedians, a lot of famous comedians now who are doing shows, who are doing like, this doesn't really apply to us, but doing like drive-in shows
and yeah.
doing outdoor, all kinds of outdoor shows. And even Joe Rogan and Dave Chappelle were doing shows where they tested everybody, you know, before the show. They've done a few of those already. So it's, you know, that seems like it's slowly gaining a momentum where where it's going to come back again. So I think that ultimately it will, and we'll be allowed to congregate. What exact form that will take? Will it be exactly the same as before? No, because it's never the same as before. I mean, everything evolves. It just maybe more.
I have a great evolution endnote for you. So you can find this online, just about the world and evolution, how things change and how we as magicians can offer hope. And since we're both cineasts and we could talk all night about film, go over to our good friend Stanley Kubrick. In 1965, he's purchased the rights to Arthur C. Clarke's novella. Mm-hmm. It was a novella. It was in a, this ran in a magazine first,
right?
Before it became a book or a movie. It was just a short, I don't know how long it was, but it wasn't long. It was, you know, 20 something pages maybe. And it was called The Sentinel. And Stanley bought this and he said, okay, I'm going to make a movie out of this. And it's going to be called 2001 Space Odyssey. And he commissions the RAND Institute, which some people think is really the Central Intelligence Agency, but whatever it is, it's a think tank of really smart guys who figure stuff out so people can keep living, basically. And so Stanley sends him a couple of $1,000s and he goes, okay, guys, it's 1965. I'm about to release a movie in 1968 called 2001. So can you tell me what the world of 2001 will look like? So they give him a 12-point memo, which is on a touring exhibition of Kubrickiana in 2001. And it was this exhibit was last February when I saw it was at the Museum of the Moving Image. It's massive. I mean, give yourself 3 hours to make the first dent in it. It's
wow.
enormous, this exhibit. Fully worth it if you dig Kubrick or 2001. Mm-hmm. So you come to this lighted case and you go, wow, Stanley Kubrick was doing some research for 2001, 1965. Hey, here's a memo that gives 12 things of what the world's going to look like in 2001, and you start reading it, and I'll leave it for the listener to find on their own. But of the 12 things they mentioned roughly, I would say 8 of them are spot on the money. It's like, well, cell phones with pictures and two-way coordination between the moon and this and that, and every... People don't realize because it's a movie and because now, you know, Elon Musk shoots something off. Big deal. You know, it's like no big deal. But in 1968, for him to have released that movie where the guy goes to make a video phone call, he's flying to the moon, he's making a video call. You and I could be on a video call right now.
That's right.
It's like no big, but in 1968, this was science fiction.
Right.
Today, it's just science or reality. And it, what's weird is that if you and I want to really nerd out on magic, we'll pull out our technical treaties, or no, excuse me, our theoretical treaties of Sam Sharp and Henning Nelms and Daryl Fitzke and all the people you and I have just talked about. Mm-hmm. And we'll see that the world actually mirrors the anticipatory goal of those books.
Right.
You know, the whole Peter Pan ethic discussed in the beginning of Neo Magic is like, why would anybody buy into this? And mm-hmm. his conclusion is because they have to. You don't breathe without feeling wonder. You've forgotten about it, but when you were a baby, every breath was really great. It's like, look, I'm breathing. Do that. I went in, I went out. Shit, I'm alive. This is incredible. And that has disappeared. And I think that we're reawakening to that because everything is, you know, really not great. And I just hope that I keep writing all these, like, you know, depressive things like, well, if I live to see that, you know,
right.
But But here's the last important thing. I know we're going on. But don't you feel, I'm serious, don't you, because there, as you said, small cadre of people. Mm-hmm. Aren't you glad you did what you set out to do?
Absolutely.
And see, and you're like, you know, I really think I'm cut out for bigger things than this.
Yeah, or certainly different things.
Or different, okay, but more, let's agree, more independent?
Yeah.
Okay, well, me too.
And that would be considered bigger, I guess, yeah.
Well, here's the thing, man. You run your own ship. You run your own business. When you turn in your tax return, I'm going to bet it says self. So, yeah,
exactly.
So me too. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying everybody should be self-employed. I know people who could be self-employed, but they don't want either to work that hard or they just don't have the drive. They'd rather come in, find their piece of paper that tells them what to do, and they go ahead and do it. They put the paper away, they go home, they come back, there's a new piece of paper, done. And I'm a real junkie for talent. You know, I'm like you. I really dig somebody who does something well. I don't care what it is. I don't care if you make clocks well. You know, it's like, wow, you really took the time to really think about this.
Right.
I really groove on that. And what I'm hoping is that when this pandemic is over, if it's conceivably over in our lifetimes, that people come out of it with this spirit of, hey, I just survived a pandemic. I will write that novel. Or if I can survive that, when I'm working a job, and then I just worked on the street for 8 years or whatever it is, mm-hmm. I can do anything. I think that's worth such an old cliche. So it's worth all the tea in China, you know? It's like, what could be bigger than self-reliance? I have not found anything. Nothing.
Writing a follow-up book. Not really a follow-up book. It'll be a completely different book. It's not a sequel or anything to the book I just wrote. But it's about this very thing. And in many ways, I would say. It's more autobiographical. It's got a working title of What Would a Lion Do?
Okay.
And yeah, it's going to speak to many of the things that are maybe many of the reasons why people don't take a risk on themselves or.
This sounds very pat. It's not, it's severely ground and reground thinking, which is that, for many years growing up, I was told you cannot make a living as a magician. And I as a brash young man, watch me.
Right.
And I did. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes it was really good and sometimes it was really bad. And most of the time, it was more than okay. Like I had the rent covered, I had food, I had a girlfriend, and I had a gig. But I wasn't knocking down any doors. I mean, I was not being fast-tracked to be a star. I was just like, Marvin Roy, a great magician, said, being a good magician is like being a bartender. You'll always work, but you're not going to get rich. And you may hear 1,000 stories and develop human acumen, but you know, you got to see this for what it is. So what I realized was that all the people telling me I couldn't do something had never tried to do the thing that they were telling me that I couldn't do.
Right.
Even if they were people of position, power, money, authority, mm-hmm. leverage. You know, I had some very wealthy people tell me, well, you can't make a living doing that. And I didn't, you know, want to throw it back in their faces and say, yeah, mm-hmm. well, have you ever tried? What they were really saying is, hi, I'm the president of Chase National Bank. My name is David Rockefeller. You really think you're going to make that kind of money being a magician? And my answer would have been, had that conversation occurred, well, no, I don't want the responsibility of that kind of money because anybody who has millions of dollars has to have a mechanism to take care of it. You know what? Mm-hmm. I don't want to be bothered. I want to be out there doing card tricks, making people smile. That's what I want to do. And if I can get paid enough doing it, I'm good.
Right.
And most people don't understand that because they have the responsibility of caring for other people, ergo their parents when you get older or your children if you have any. I realized very early on that if I was going to do, you know, it's going to be my little recalcitrant hardcore self that if the phone rang, The answer would be yes, I'd make a sale, and I would be on the next plane to wherever to do the gig. Like, that was my life. That one, I could never have children. Two, I barely wanted to be married. Like, why be married?
Right.
What does that bring to the equation? Except that magicians don't hire assistants, they marry them. So you know, after a while, it just became silly between me and my wife of 25 years that, number one, she would accept this lifestyle. Mm-hmm. That if the phone rang and I had to be in Japan in 3 days, I was going to be in Japan for 3 days. Even if we were bound to take a vacation. Sorry, vacation is over. See this ring on my finger? I'm married to being a magician. I gotta go. Now, that could change, but it hasn't yet. Now, that's a pretty hard group of rules to join up to. But I happened to marry somebody who also didn't want to have children and wanted to be a dancer.
Right.
So dance to her was magic to me. And somehow we made it work. But it's not easy. See, that's the other thing about this hope, meaning, it's that what we do is not easy. And my fear, as I said earlier, is that there's not a 12-year-old reading a magic book, Royal Road, Killer Choice, under the covers by flashlight, saying, someday I'm going to be a great magician, and I don't care if I have to spend 20 years with one deck of cards. After I spend that 20 years with that one deck of cards, I will be able to have another 40 or 50 years and being able to go anywhere in the world and subsist. It frightens me. It really does.
Well, I think maybe what will happen, there won't be that person perhaps, but maybe they'll come to it in a different manner.
Such as?
Well, that maybe they'll be, instead of like having a print book under their bed covers at night, they'll be scrolling TikTok, 2 years from now, and they'll see something about some magic book that they haven't read, and they'll be intrigued. And if they really are interested legitimately, then they'll seek out that thing and they can get it in a digital copy. I mean,
I hope so. Maybe the chip that's implanted in all the baby's brains now will have a right. Called to our bell. Like, Johnny, have you done your magic lesson for the day? Oh, sorry, Mom, let me switch on to that. I don't know.
I don't know.
It will be different now.
That's a guarantee. It will be different.
It will be different. Last question. You're a book guy, right? Do you have lots of books?
Yeah.
Okay.
Although I will say that when I decided to street perform, most of what I did with my books was digitize them.
Okay, fine. But the point is, you realize, and for everybody listening to this, I hope you realize that, and I love Michael Amar. Michael and I are cohabiting people on the planet Earth as magicians.
Yeah.
I respect Michael Amar. I think he's insane to do 6 shows a night at the parlor, but that's beside the point. Everything that Michael Amar knows and teaches brilliantly and well was because Michael Amar read books. Michael was not raised on videos. He ushered in the video revolution.
Right.
But where Michael got his stuff, at least in principle, he'll tell you. Mm-hmm. He read The Fine Art of Magic by Kaplan. Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, this, do this. And then he made it his own, and then it's his own to teach in his books and videos and downloads and everything else he does brilliantly. So I'm not down on the teaching via an iPad or the internet or anything like that. So books may have bitten the dust as far as what we're discussing. The tenacious factor, David, I'd like you to address real quick before we say goodbye, is that you really got to stick to it, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, the secrets that are kept in the books that everyone is, that people who really aren't magicians often salivate over, and then many stories have been spun as to like this underground level of secrets and so forth. The real secret is something you've already spoken to, which is, it's just, you have to do it.
That's right.
That's the secret. I often tell people when inquiring about performing or street performing, I tell them, the secret is there is no shortcut. You just have to do it. That's the shortcut, actually doing it, because most people just don't do it. So, you know, the real shortcut is to just put in the work. And I think you can learn 18 methods to produce four aces, but none of them will be any good unless you're going to put some of yourself into it and use that, what you're putting into it, to connect with other human beings. Is otherwise it'll just be always remain trivial and surface level.
That's right. If they don't have a reason for doing it, a reason or a meaning will never translate to the audience. And therefore, if it doesn't, why are you out there?
Yeah. Why are you showing? That's one question I always put to people is, why are you showing me these tricks?
Yeah.
Like, you know, when you can start to answer that with a more altruistic answer, you'll be well on your way probably to getting more serious about your magic.
Yeah. It's a really important and good conversation. I recommend Max Howard's Creating Theatrical Magic. It's not so heavy. It's very practical. The other thing I was talking about with somebody, I got to go, is that you and I in this discussion have talked a lot about doing it, getting out there and doing it. And the magicians, this is, I've been accused of being old school, like that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
I got news for
you. I think it's a good thing, actually.
I got news for you people. Old school is the only school.
Yeah, because that proves you've been to school.
Yeah. And by the way, it's worked. It's worked for 100 years. It worked for Charlie Chaplin. It works for me. It works. Don't tell me that old school's bad school because it's old. This doesn't work. But the old school, if you look at David Devant or John Mulholland or Milburn Christopher or John Scarney or John Booth, just find a writer in magic who really made their living as a magician. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are less famous people like Ed Patterson, who's a school show magician in New Jersey, did 230 shows a year.
Right.
This guy lived at the gas station. Are you kidding me? I mean, he could load in his show, do his show, and load out his show inside of an hour. I mean, that's how tight this guy was. Well, the point is, those people like Mr. Patterson or John Booth or John Mulholland, they are few and far between. Most of those lecture notes that you read, great stuff, interesting, but did they have 40-year careers? I mean, this is the real deal, folks. And if you're going to listen to whomever who doesn't have those credits or life experiences, I think you're shortchanging yourselves. You're not looking in the right place for what really went down. And even when you do look for what really went down, you still have to interpret it for this age. It's a different ball game. So number one, start in the right place, find people who really did it. Two, put in the time, read it. And I would even encourage sacrilegious me, write in the margins, use these as textbooks. Take a pencil or a pen and actually write questions, underline things, you know, talk to the book, talk to the medium, do it in your iPad, make tracking notes, whatever you do. But engage with the thing. Don't just read it until you fall asleep, but start the conversation. Because once you do, the conversation does not end. You know as well as I do that you and I are going to be ripping through our theoretical books, like going, yeah, now Ben mentioned this. I got to check that out. Like, David, I was talking about hitting the albums. What page was that? No, I mean, you really do have to engage the conversation. And number three, if you can possibly learn to do one or two things really, really well, then you're on your way. You don't need to learn 10 tricks. You need to learn two tricks or three tricks. That's it. And get that down super duper well. And I promise you will prosper. So that's all I have to say.